We are in 2 Samuel. We finished 21 last time. That was, among other things, the chronicling of ridding the land of giants. From 15 through 22, we have the giants that were killed by David's mighty men. So that's going to bring us to 22, and I'm going to skip 22. 2 Samuel 22 is the same thing as Psalm 18. It's wonderful, but for purposes of what we're doing in this study, it's extraneous. What I've been doing in the study has been focusing on the change in Israel from a system of judges to a monarchy, and then the problems that the monarchy has going forward. And the other thing that I have wanted to talk about is fatherhood with Samuel and David. So the psalm in chapter 22 is a wonderful psalm, but that's not what I'm talking about. So I want to go to 23, and again, there's some poetry by David, but this is actually germane to what we're doing, because he's talking about the qualifications of leadership and kingship. Beginning of 23, verse 1, "Now these are the last words of David, the oracle of David, the son of Jesse, the oracle of the man who was raised on high, anointed by the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel. The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me. His word is on my tongue. The God of Israel has spoken. The Rock of Israel has said to me, when one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, he dawns on them like the morning light, like the sun shining forth on a cloudless morning, like rain that makes grass to sprout upon the earth." Now, I'm not sure who he is that dawns. It could obviously be God. It also could be the benign face of the king. So we have in Proverbs, for example, that you don't want to make the king mad because bad things will happen to you. And if you have a good ruler, people are happy. If you have a lousy ruler, people are... So he dawns on them like the morning light could be the benevolent rule of a just king, or it could be God responding to a just king's rule. In either case, it fits with the rest of Scripture, which has the emphasis, of course, on justice and right rule and so forth. Back in verse 2, it says, "The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me. His word is on my tongue." One of the things that most people believe, myself very much included, are a lot of the Psalms are prophetic. So things are said in the Psalms by the psalmist that turn out to be prophetic. And of course, David wrote just a whole bunch of the Psalms. So this verse 2, "The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me, his word is on my tongue," I see David as saying, a lot of the stuff that I have said in the Psalms is not from me, it's from God. Verse 5, "For does not my house stand so with God? For he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For will he not cause to prosper all my help and my desire? But worthless men are all like thorns that are thrown away, for they cannot be taken with the hand. But the man who touches them arms himself with iron and the shaft of a spear, and they are utterly consumed with fire." Pronouns here are actually much more straightforward. First off, of course, God did make a covenant with David that as long as his sons followed in his footsteps, they would never lack a man of the line of David to sit on the throne. And of course, we all know that Yeshua the Messiah is of the line of David, the ultimate king. And then this business of worthless men are like thorns that are thrown away. They cannot be taken by the hand. The idea of reaching out and grabbing a thorn bush with a bare hand and plucking it out, that's not the way to deal with such people. You deal with them with implements. And in this case, he arms himself with iron and the shaft of a spear. So the idea is these worthless men that are disturbing the body politic need to be rooted out. The idea that you can't grasp them with your hand is sort of a metaphor that they are not going to be talked into changing. They have to be dealt with forcefully. The comment was that she had been reading Isaiah 60, which is, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you." So the idea, of course, of God being a light to Israel, especially when they are being governed properly. Passage in 2 Samuel, the pronoun could work either way, and it does work either way. So now we're going to get a list of the mighty men of David, and this is actually more than simply a chronicling. It gives the background on some of the other stories that we hear. So these are the names of the mighty men whom David had: Josheb Basebath, the Tachmonite. He was chief of the three. He wielded his spear against 800, whom he killed at one time. I was listening to Ron Dart, a month or so ago, and he was in the same passage of Scripture. And the idea of one guy slaughtering 800 is a bit far-fetched. And what he said was kind of interesting, that at that particular time, warfare was man-on-man, with sword and spear. So what our hero might have done is, during the initial clash, he took out his guy, then he turned to help the next guy with him, with the guy he was fighting, and when they took that guy, he turned to help. So it isn't necessarily the case that he personally slew all 800 of them, so much as he was helping other people with the man they were facing. Don't know if that's true or not. It's just a comment by Ron Dart I thought was interesting. Verse 9. And next to him among the three mighty men was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, son of Ahoy. He was with David when they defied the Philistines, who were gathering there for battle, and the men of Israel withdrew. He rose and struck down the Philistine until his hand was weary, and his hand clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the men returned after him only to strip the slain. So the idea is that he is standing sort of like the Greeks at Thermopylae. He's obviously in a place where they have to come at him singly, and he slays a bunch of them. I find this one, that his hand clung to the sword, interesting. As many of you know, I am a 1950s black and white samurai movie fan. Toshiro Mifune and Akira Kurosawa, the classic Japanese samurai, they're wonderful. They're all in Japanese with English subtitles. But anyway, there's one where this samurai is a mighty man like that. He goes into battle with his sword, and they win the battle, and they find him on the battlefield sort of rocking, and they can't get his hand unclipped from his sword. His hand is frozen to his sword, and they have to literally pry his fingers off to get the sword out of his hand. Whenever I read this passage here in Kings, I think of that scene in the movie. Very dramatic. So verse 11. And next to him was Shema, the son of Agi, the Hararite. The Philistines gathered together at Lehi, where there was a plot of ground full of lentils. And the men fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and struck down the Philistines, and the Lord worked a great victory. All of this very much reminds one of the stories of Samson, where the Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson and he picked up the jawbone of an ass and slew a whole bunch of people, or Spirit of the Lord came upon him and he grabs a lion and tears it apart with his bare hands. Very much reminiscent of those kinds of stories. And of course, you can read in there between the lines that the Spirit of the Lord came upon these men and enabled them to do those things. Verse 13. And three of the 30 chief men went down and came about a harvest time to David in the cave of Adullam. All right, now so this is hearkening back to when David was fleeing from Saul, and he was rumbling around in southern Judah. And three of the 30 chief men went down and came about harvest time to David at the cave of Adullam, where a band of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was at Bethlehem. So the Philistines at that point had taken Bethlehem. And David said longingly, Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem that is by the gate. So he was born in Bethlehem. He grew up in Bethlehem. Obviously, different wells of water will have different taste. And as he's out there in the field, worrying about what he's going to do next, he's sort of, oh man, I wish I had a drink of water from the well of my child. You know, it was that kind of a thing. Nothing more serious than that. The comment was that it could also simply mean, I wish Bethlehem were free and I could go to the well anytime I wanted to, as opposed to having it clobbered up with all the Philistines. Yeah, that works too. Verse 16. Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and carried and brought it to David. But he would not drink of it. He poured it out to the Lord. This is interesting because what it does is it talks about the way David's men thought about it. David was a charismatic leader. You remember when he fled from Saul, he attracted several hundred men to him. And one of the reasons that they came to him is that he was charismatic. People liked being around him. People wanted to do things for him. So the idea of these three guys busting in and getting him a glass of water from Bethlehem says two things. One, of course, the esteem in which they held David. The other thing it could be is bravado. We're the mighty men here. That's what you want. By golly, we're going to make it happen. I don't know that it was entirely bravado, but certainly I don't think that was absent from the calculation. So David pours it out to the Lord and said, far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of the men who went at the risk of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. These things the three mighty men did. So these are the three guys we've talked about up to now. Now Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief of the 30. And he wielded his spear against 300 men and killed them and won a name besides the three. He was the most renowned of the 30 and became their commander. But he did not attain to the three. So the reputation of the three top guys, you got to go some to get up to that level. Killing a mere 300 men just doesn't cut it. But my point is, these guys are all rough guys. 20. And Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant man of Kabzeel, a doer of great deeds. He struck down two aerials of Moab. He also went down and struck down a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen. All right. The note in my Bibles is we're not sure what aerials mean. Aerial, by the way, is lion in Hebrew. So I'm not sure what it is, what two aerials are, and the commentary that I have with it is not sure either. But it could refer to two mighty men of Moab who were known as lions in the army. That's a guess. I have nothing better than that. But as I say, it may be, you know, like the David's three mighty men. These are two lions of Moab. It could very well be something like that. 21. And he struck down an Egyptian, a handsome man. The Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but Benaiah went down to him with a staff and snatched the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. This reminds me of my samurai movies. One of them is a trilogy played by Toshiro Mifune. Toshiro Mifune is sort of the John Wayne of Japan. And one of the things is he's challenged to a duel. And he goes to the duel with a wooden sword and kills the guy. In fact, in the scene, as he's taking a boat ride to get to the island where this challenge is going to be met, he's got a stick and he's whittling himself a sword. And he gets out and uses that sword that he just whittled to kill this other samurai. So I'm sort of reminded again of that when Benaniah goes down with just a staff, a wooden rod, takes the Egyptian spear away from him and kills him. There's nothing new under the sun. 22. These things did Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, and won a name besides the three mighty men. He was renowned among the 30, but he did not attain to the three, and David set him over his bodyguard. And we'll see Benaniah a bit later. Now, Asahel, the brother of Joab, was one of the 30. Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem. Remember, Asahel was the one that was killed by Abner. And then Joab avenged his death by killing Abner. So Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem, Shema of Herod, Elikah of Herod, Helez the Pelethite, Ira the son of Ikshay of Tekoa, Abiezer of Anathoth, Mibunai the Hushite. I'm going to skip these guys, but where I want to go down to is verse 34. Eliphelet, the son of Ashbi of Maacah, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel of Gilo. Eliam is Bathsheba's father. That makes, of course, Ahithophel Bathsheba's grandfather, which we said when we were talking about of the adultery. And then, of course, the last guy is 39, Uriah the Hittite, 37 in all. So Uriah is one of the mighty men. Eliam is one of the mighty men. Eliam, as I say, is the father of Bathsheba. Bathsheba has therefore grown up in the royal court. She knows her way around power because she's the daughter of one of the mighty men and the wife of another. But the thing that I said at the time is David is their leader and commander. So for David to betray these guys is an order of magnitude more scummy than if he had seen some random good-looking wench in the marketplace and called her over. These were his family. These were his trusted warriors. These were the palace guard, if you will. And so for him to do that was really very scummy. So that will take us on now to chapter 24. Comment was how much of this combat success was due to the fact that they were just very good warriors and how much of it was the hand of God upon them. And the comment mentioned men like Audie Murphy, who held off a number of Germans and led a counterattack. Another one was Alvin York in World War I. You mentioned George Washington and the French and Indian Wars. I have no doubt that God has favorites in battles. I want this side to win and I don't want that side to win. I don't doubt that that's true. And I don't doubt that he protects and guides the ones he wants to win. Don't have any problem with that whatsoever. However, he's got to have something to work with. And these men, for example, I can remember some random comment that I read years ago about Washington. He said he was sort of like a mountain. You went around him, you didn't try to go through him. He was just that kind of a man. And clearly David was, and clearly these mighty men were. So yes, God's hand is in it, but it's sort of like at the end of Deuteronomy and at the beginning of Joshua, where Moses and the Lord give Joshua his commission. The Lord says, I will be with you, but you need to be strong and of good courage. So you're going to come up against all these various ites, Jebusites, whatever, and I'll give you the victory, but you got to take your sword out and you got to advance. And if you don't do that, there's nothing I can work with here. So as you said, these are incredibly tough, skilled warriors. And I have no doubt whatsoever that God then tipped the balance. You know, David says, all right, should I march against the Philistines? No, hang on, wait till they get over here. And then, yeah, now go get them. And same with Jephthah. I mean, these are all mighty men to start with. And then God takes what he's got to work with there and puts his finger on the scale. Kay told me a story once. Robert E. Lee, great man. And she was at Custis Lee Mansion. And the docent said, this is the room that Lee was in the night before he decided to join the Confederacy. And what he was doing was praying all night. And this isn't from God, this is from a historian, okay? And God assured him that he should go with the Confederacy. Not because God wanted the Confederacy to win, but because he knew Lee would not let things go too far. Lee was a man of tremendous integrity, a very godly man, and he was not going to turn the whole United States into plowed ground. He would not let it go too far, which he didn't. I am quietly furious that my alma mater took his statue down. He was a superintendent of West Point. He was number one graduate in his class. As I say, he's a great man. And for the politically correct nonsense to erase his memory is just unconscionable. Anyway, sorry about that. So, chapter 24. Again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, go, number Israel and Judah. All right, now full stop here a minute. What's obviously going to happen is David's going to number the people, and it's going to bring a tremendous plague. Certainly, we see that God is upset that David numbers the people. That's why I'm not sure what's going on with this. He incited David against them. I don't know what that means. I don't know what's going on. It may be something that a historian writing this account threw in. I just don't know. Comment was, this is also in 1 Chronicles. And 1 Chronicles, it says, and Satan stood against Israel and incited David to number Israel. Yeah, the Septuagint says, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and Satan incited David to number. In Hebrew, has Yovah, the Masoretic text. Okay, so, at least in my mind, some confusion there. And don't get me wrong, because you remember the incident with Balaam, where God finally says to Balaam, yeah, you can go to Moab, but you won't say anything that I don't tell you to say. And then on the way, you had the angel of the Lord getting ready to kill him. So, which is it? Did God say, yeah, go ahead and go? Or is God, and it's one of those things in the Bible that are sometimes hard to unpack. And this is one of them. So I'm not sure what to do with it. You've got three different versions, if you will. You've got the Chronicles version. You've got the 2 Samuel version in the Masoretic text. And then you've got the 2 Samuel version in the Septuagint. And they are all slightly different. Two out of the three say that Satan is the one that was the inciting agent. And then one says that Jehovah was. So do with that as seems good to you. I can't do any better other than to point it out. Verse 2. So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army, who was with him, go throughout all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and number the people, that I may know the number of the people. But Joab said to the king, may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as there are, while the eyes of my lord the king will see it. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing? So Joab says, bad idea. But the king's word prevailed against Joab and the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. They crossed the Jordan and began from Arar and from the city that was on the hills on the middle of the valley toward Gad and on to Jazer. Then they came to Gilead and to Kadesh in the land of the Hittites. They came to Dan, and from Dan they went around to Sidon and came to the fortress of Tyre and to all the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites. And they went out to the Negev of Judah at Beersheba. So when they had gone through all the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. And Joab gave the sum of the numbering of the people to the king. In Israel, there were 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000. So you got 1,000,003 military-aged men. Now, a couple of things. I find it interesting that we have Israel and Judah numbered separately. Not sure why that is, other than this may have been put together after the division of the kingdom. Don't know that, but that's a thought. Otherwise, I'm not sure. And notice that he's counting people up in Tyre, in Lebanon. So one of the things we said is during David's high point, he held sway all the way from the Brook of Egypt up to the Euphrates River. So the idea that he's counting his people in Lebanon is basically what's going on there. Now, the idea that David's not supposed to count them, there's two things going on there. And by the way, one of the things that I have made it an ironclad rule is I do not count the people in RMF for this exact reason. I mean, I know about how many people there are, you know, how many people you feed at a feast and so forth, but I really don't know a precise number. But there's two problems with this. Problem number one is ownership. So I don't get to go out to Travis's farm and count his sheep. They belong to Travis. They don't belong to me. The idea of counting something indicates ownership. You know, I may be the tax collector. I indirectly own all this stuff, so I'm going to get an accurate count to make sure I get what I'm owed. Or you look at your neighbor and you count his sheep and you decide, well, some of those ought to be mine. So the first one is ownership. And the idea that David owns Israel as the king is one thing that's going on here that is wrong. And then thing two is God has said to David, when you go out to battle, when I'm with you, you're going to win. Doesn't matter how many people you have. The idea then of counting the army smacks of, could I do this without God? Do I have enough soldiers here to take on whoever it is without the help of God and in my own strength, my own power, etc.? So those are the two problems that we have with numbering the people. One is it demonstrates that you're relying on yourself and worldly resources instead of relying on God. And then the second is that you are asserting ownership where the people belong to God. Either one of those would be sufficient for God to get grumpy with it. Verse 10. But David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people, and David said to the Lord, I have sinned in what I have done. The idea that somebody moved David to do this, either Satan or Jehovah, he doesn't get remorseful until he's actually got the number in his hand. And then he realizes, whoops, we have messed up. I have messed up. So he says, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. And when David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, go and say to David, thus says the Lord, three things I offer you. Choose one of them that I may do it to you. So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, shall 3 years of famine come into your land? Or shall you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land? Now notice the cascade here. 3 years of famine, 3 months of harassment like what was happening with Saul, or 3 days of pestilence. And I sort of get the idea since that all three of these in God's eyes are equivalent. That the idea of 3 days of pestilence is going to take out as many people as 3 years of famine would. I get the idea that these are equivalent, even though they're cascading. Let me see, I've got a note there. Compare with 1 Chronicles 21:12, either 3 years of famine or 3 months of devastation by your foes, while the sword of your enemy overtakes you, or else 3 days of the sword of the Lord, pestilence on the land, with the angel of the Lord destroying throughout all the territory of Israel. So Chronicles is three. The Septuagint is three. The Masoretic text is seven. So my translation, which is English Standard, is going with the Septuagint and Chronicle. But the Masoretic text has seven. Thank you for pointing that out. Or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in the land? Now consider and decide what answer I shall return to him who sent me. So this is Gad speaking. God gave him the three choices. He goes to David, lays them out, and then says, let me know what to go back and say. Then David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercy is great. But let me not fall into the hand of man. This is by way of backing out what he did. The idea of numbering all the troops indicates that my success is in my own hands and in the might of the army. And so what he's saying here is, I put myself in your hands, which is where I should have stayed. Verse 15. So the Lord sent a pestilence on Israel from the morning until the appointed time. And there died of the people from Dan to Beersheba 70,000 men. And when the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel, who was working destruction among the people, it is enough. Now stay your hand. And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people and said, behold, I have sinned and I have done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and my father's house. So demonstrating one of the reasons that David is a man after God's own heart. When he messes up, he stands up and he takes responsibility and he says, I can't buy this off with the blood of my people. I'm the one that you want. Verse 18. Gad came that day to David and said to him, go up. Raise an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. By the way, the threshing floor of Araunah, a threshing floor is on a hill where you've got airflow over it. And, you know, you throw the grain up in the air and the breeze blows the chaff off and the grain drops. Threshing floors in Scripture are a metaphor for judgment. Things happen on threshing floors that involve judgment. Third thing is, this is where the Temple Mount is. So the current Temple Mount is right there. That's what's being established. This is where God eventually is going to have his house built. 19. So David went up at Gad's word, as the Lord commanded. And when Araunah looked down, he saw the king and his servants coming on toward him. And Araunah went out and paid homage to the king with his face to the ground. And Araunah said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? When the king and his staff all walk into your farm, it's like, what's going on? So David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be averted from the people. Then Araunah said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what seems good to him. Here are the oxen for the burnt offering, and the threshing sledges and the yoke of the oxen for the wood. All this, O king, Araunah gives to the king. And Araunah said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. In other words, I will give you everything you need for your sacrifice, and I pray that God will accept your sacrifice. 24. But the king said to Araunah, no, but I will buy it from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing. So again, David's character. Now, he does dumb stuff and he sins and so forth, but he accepts correction really well. So when God corrects him, he gets the message and does what's right. This is an indication of his character. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord responded to the plea for the land, and the plague was averted from Israel. So that's the end of 2 Samuel. In order to finish the thought, we're going to do the first chapter and a half of 1 Kings, because that's the transfer of power and so forth. So we'll do that next time, and then that'll be the end of this series, if you will.